Good timing. Right at the wire.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen.
Frau und Herr. So we were talking about the executive branch, and we're talking about constitutional stuff, vis-a-vis the president, things that are constitutional, things that are not necessarily in the Constitution, such as, obviously, we know how the impeachment process works, we know the official powers of the president, but there are things like the cabinet that are not really in the Constitution. But we left off talking about what happens if there is no president. Well, we know, basically, Article 2, Section 1, Clause 6 states that if the president dies or resigns or is removed via impeachment, that the vice president becomes president. And going back to the first time that happened, when John Tyler became president upon the death of William Henry Harrison, from that point on, if that situation occurs, the vice president essentially becomes the president. And of course, as we said, that process was codified in the 25th Amendment. But here's something interesting. What happens if the president becomes incapacitated? So he's not dead, didn't resign, he's just medically unable to perform his job. Well, that was addressed also in the 25th Amendment. And this should be an amendment that you should take a look at. According to Section 3, it states, and I don't know if you can read it, but it's there, whenever the president transmits to the president pro tempore of the Senate and the Speaker of the House his written declaration, he is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office, and until he transmits to them written declaration to the contrary, such powers and duties shall be discharged by the vice president as acting president. Back when George W. Bush was president, he went in for a colonoscopy. When he was knocked out, essentially, by all legal definition, he was incapacitated. So prior to him going into the procedure, he sent, as called for by the 25th Amendment, just a letter to the Speaker and the President pro tempore of the Senate. Hey, look, I'm going in for this medical procedure. I'm going to be out at this time. Well, at that point, Dick Cheney essentially became acting president. But after the procedure was done and he was awakened from being knocked out, he then transmitted to both, hey, I'm back on my feet. And at that point, George W. Bush was able to resume the role as president. So that's a temporary situation. But this one was popularized when Trump was president the first time, because all of the Democrats who wanted to basically destroy the president, although I'll be honest with you, I think it was also mentioned when Biden was president as well. What happens if the president loses his mind? Well, under Section 4 of the 25th Amendment, that deals with this as well. And essentially it states that the vice president and the majority of either the cabinet or any such body provided by law feels the president cannot fulfill his duties and obligations, then they can send a letter to the president pro tempore and the speaker, essentially declaring they don't think the president can do the job. Now, this has never been used But the intent behind this section goes back to when Woodrow Wilson was president of the United States and he suffered a stroke. Actually, he suffered a series of debilitating strokes. After the first stroke, the president's wife never let Woodrow Wilson appear in public again. He never appeared at any cabinet meetings again. Essentially, he was completely bedridden. Now, written orders were coming from his office, but it was long rumored that it wasn't the president actually running the show, that it was his wife. Similar situation happened during the last year of Joe Biden's presidency, particularly after the debate against Trump. For all sakes and purposes, he pretty much disappeared. And Jill Biden and Hunter Biden were attending the security briefings as well as the cabinet meetings. Well, it shouldn't be the first lady. It shouldn't be the son of the president. But the problem with this mechanism, obviously, if it's the vice president in the cabinet, who are they loyal to? They're loyal to the president. So there's no way that either Trump's guys, when they were talking about it when Trump was president the first time, nor Biden's guys, when Biden was in office, was ever going to do that. But if there ever was a situation where, again, a president suffered something blatantly debilitating, then I assume we may see it. Hasn't happened since the 25th Amendment was ratified, but you never know. Now, by the way, how long in that situation would V. POTUS be acting president? Well, until either the president notified the Senate pro tempore and the Speaker of the House, or the acting president in the cabinet notifies that the president's fit to resume their duties. But if you think about it, the 25th Amendment was ratified in 1967. So we had almost 200 years of history where this potential issue was not addressed. But why did they codify it? Again, based on things that were happening. Questions? All right. Well, we know what happens if the president is vacant. Article 2, Section 1, Clause 6 says V. POTUS becomes president. But what happens if something happens to both POTUS and V. POTUS? Well, according to Article 2, Section 1, Clause 6, it's up to Congress to decide. And interestingly enough, Congress has dealt with this, not once, not twice, but three times. And each time, they tweaked it a little bit. And these were done under laws called the Presidential Succession Acts. Now, under the very first one, 1792, Congress basically said, if something happens to the president in the V. POTUS, then the president pro tempore becomes acting president. If something happened to POTUS, V. POTUS, and president pro tempore under this original law, then it would be the speaker. But here's the interesting thing. If either the president pro tempore or the speaker becomes acting president, they had to send word immediately to all of the governors, and all of the governors would have to organize a special election to essentially elect a new president. While that law was in effect, that never happened. But there were 10 vice presidential vacancies. But there was a president. so it was never authorized. So the first vice president, not that you need to know the names, to die in office was George Clinton. He was Madison's vice president. He died on April 12th, 1812. There was Elbridge Gerry, who was Madison's second vice president. So job security, life security, don't serve as vice president for James Madison. You will die. Both of his did. Elbridge Gerry died on 1814. John C. Calhoun, he was Andrew Jackson's vice president. He resigned from office on December 28th, 1832. John Tyler, when he became president, that meant he had no vice president. Millard Fillmore became president. Again, there was a vacancy. No vice president. William R. King died 1853. Andrew Johnson became president when Lincoln was shot. Henry Wilson died 1875. Chester Arthur became president. And the last one was Thomas Hendricks, who died November 25th, 1885. Oh, I never realized I pulled this down. So, in light of how many vacancies there were, because again, we all know everyone is going to die. So Congress in 1886 decided to take up the measure. They decided then that it was better not to have the leaders in the Congress become acting president. Instead, they replaced the president pro tempore and the Speaker of the House with members of the cabinet, based on order that they were created. So Washington's first cabinet, the first position created, was Secretary of State, then was Secretary of the Treasury, Secretary of the War, Attorney General, etc., etc. If, under that law, there was a vacancy, then the Secretary would assume job as acting president. But it was up to Congress to call a special election. They reserved in themselves the right. Never happened under that law. Never happened. But there were five vice presidential vacancies because there was never a mechanism to fill the vice presidency. So Garrett Hobart died, who was McKinley's first president, vice president in 1899. Teddy Roosevelt became president in 1901. James Sherman, who was Taft's vice president, died in 1912. Calvin Coolidge became president. Harry Truman became president. But in 1947, Congress would again act. And what motivated Congress to act in 1947? The threat of thermonuclear war. The moment we unleashed the atom, that was a game changer. Recognizing Washington, D.C. essentially could get hit by a nuke. That there needed to be a long contingency plan just in case. So in 1947, what they did is they combined both acts, both the original one and the revision. But they switched things up. Now, under the law, it goes POTUS, VPOTUS, Speaker, President pro tempore, then the cabinet in the order of creation. Of course, there are now 15 cabinet seats. So now we have a bench of 18 people, just in case something happens to the president.
That's where lone survivor comes from.
Exactly. Exactly. So, if you ever watch joint session of Congress, when the president speaks, or the State of the Union, there is always somebody not there. There's always a member of the cabinet not present. There is always a member of the Supreme Court not present. There are already leaders in both chambers not present. Those are the contingency plans. The other thing that the last revision did, it eliminated the need for a special session. So God forbid something happens and the Secretary of Education becomes president, just like Battlestar Galactica, that would be the president. Questions? Oh, here's a loophole. What happens if both the president-elect and the VPOTUS-elect is vacant? So there's a vacancy created after the election, but before Inauguration Day. Well, that's covered under the 20th Amendment, which was ratified in 1933. This, by the way, was also the law that changed Inauguration Day. Originally, Inauguration Day was March 4th. But in 1933, Congress felt that was too much of a lame duck period from the time of the election in November until March 4th. So this is when they changed it. So under the 20th Amendment, the first day of the new Congress is January 4th. And the first day of the new president is January 20th. But going back to this question, what happens if they're both vacant? Well, if the VPOTUS elect dies, if the POTUS elect dies, then the VPOTUS elect becomes president. If both are dead, they follow the Presidential Succession Act. So, what does that mean? Congress picks who the successor is going to be. Oh, I should mention one thing. Both under the Presidential Succession Act of 47 and the 20th Amendment, the person who becomes acting president must be qualified to be acting president. So, they have to be a natural born citizen. No immigrants can ever become acting president or president of the United States. They have to be a natural born citizen. And why? Well, the founding fathers were terrified of people having dual interests. Because if you were not born here, or if you immigrated here, your first loyalty is not going to be these United States of America. You're going to have sympathy to your home country. So the founding fathers wanted to make sure that only natural-born citizens could become president. Now, that's not to say a natural-born citizen couldn't be a traitor. But again, that's what impeachment's for. Questions? So make sure you take a look at the 20th Amendment, the 25th Amendment, and of course, the presidential, the clause in the Constitution, all the things that I'm talking about for the next exam. All right. What about the vice presidency? Well, the vice presidency has evolved over the history of the United States. And the evolution and change pretty much derives from the nature of the relationship between the POTUS and the VPOTUS. Originally, George Washington did not necessarily rely upon John Adams. That in part is one of the reasons why John Adams attempted to preside over sessions of the Senate. But after the Senate basically kicked him out, John Adams was there. He would attend cabinet meetings, but Washington primarily relied upon his cabinet members. So he listened to Hamilton in particular. But he also gave respect to Jefferson's word. Beyond that, for the most part, the primary job of the vice president simply was to have a heartbeat. Because the job of the vice president was basically to be on the bench. And again, there have been many instances when the vice president has become president. But prior to that elevation, they would do pretty much whatever the president wanted them to do. So they would go to ceremonies, they would go to a state fair, they'd do ribbon cuttings, you know, things like that. Of course, with the advent on the ability to travel the globe easily, you know, that also, you know, resulted in presidents in the 20th century going on a ship and go visiting, you know, other countries as an emissary of the President of the United States. But, beginning again with the Cold War era, the job of the vice president was significant. Previously, the vice president was chosen to also kind of help balance out the ticket. So if you were a southern candidate for president, you wanted a northerner who was going to be vice president. If you were on the mid-Atlantic coast, you wanted someone from the Midwest. You know, you wanted to get that geographical balance. But in the more modern era, vice presidents were chosen more for ideological reasons. Presidential candidates wanted to make sure that the vice presidential candidate was lockstep in barrel with the policies and the ideology of themselves. They didn't want someone who would clash with them. Why? Well, again, you wanted to have a reliable person that if there was a tie in the Senate, that would go in there and consistently vote the way that the White House wanted. But vice presidential candidates would also be assigned special tasks by the president. So, for instance, did you know that Joe Biden, when Obama was president, was actually tasked to be the head of a Doge-like policy? Obama actually ran on and talked about several times during his presidency the need to cut out waste and fraud and all the rest. And it was supposed to be Joe Biden who was supposed to do it. Of course, Joe Biden never did it, but he was tasked with that job. When Biden was president, he tasked Kamala Harris with being the border czar. Of course, she didn't do anything, but the president wanted her to be out there. He also made her like the IAI czar or some other things. But you have some vice presidents that were part of the deep state. Dick Cheney. Many people strongly believe that the reason why we went into Iraq after 9/11 was due to the workings of this man and all of his connections with the deep state.
Halliburton.
Mm-hmm. So yes, what I'm saying is it's all likelihood the United States went to war for profit of a private company. Pence also had an important job, if you remember back during the COVID. Trump put Pence in charge of the COVID response. J.D. Vance, I don't know if Trump has given him a job yet, but J.D. Vance seems to be there on all of the important meetings. Although J.D. Vance, actually, he did go over to Europe, right? Didn't he go to NATO and basically talk them down? Basically let them know that the administration intends on them actually paying their fair share?
He just got back from Greenland, too.
Oh, yeah, he went to the bases in Greenland, right. Yeah, exactly. So what is going to be the role of future vice presidents? Again, it basically depends upon the president. Relationship with the president. Literally, that's quick. Click. All right. The modern vice presidency has also been acted by amendments to the Constitution. The first is the 22nd Amendment, which was ratified in 1951. It is the 22nd Amendment where the two terms for president was implemented. Of course, it was implemented because of Franklin Delano Roosevelt being the only man to break the precedent set by George Washington. George Washington did two terms. He could have stayed president for the rest of his life. And ironically, if he would have ran for a third term, he would have lived longer than he actually did. But he died because he got sick in retirement while he was out, you know, working on his estate. But I've read some historians that suggest if he would have actually bet, because he only died, he was in his 50s when he died. And he was in good health before he got sick. Oh, by the way, Washington also died in part because of his belief in bloodletting. So the best way to cure a sickness was to have them drain your blood. But anyways.
Balancing the humor.
Yeah, exactly.
So stupid.
Exactly. Well, hey, no. That was science. You can't mock science. Science going back 2,000 years. Because after all, I'm sure there was someone like Fauci who said, I am the science, and said, this is the way it is.
Just let people bleed out. Oh.
Yeah.
Well, he must have been really sick.
Yeah. All right. So how does the two-term limit impact the vice president? Well, the reason being is if the sitting president dies, resigns, or is removed, the vice president becomes president for the remainder of the term. But here's the catch. If it's less than 2 years, that is considered under the 22nd Amendment as being a full term. So, for example, when Chester Arthur became president upon the death of Garfield, or when Teddy Roosevelt became president upon the death of William McKinley, or Tyler on Harrison, that was basically in the first few months of the beginning of a term. So in each of those instances, because it was 3 years plus months, that would be considered that president's first term, meaning he only could run for a second term. But when Lyndon Baines Johnson became president upon the assassination of John Fitzgerald Kennedy in November of 1963, because it was only 1 year left, Johnson could have ran again in 68. But because of how bad he was screwing up Vietnam, there was a dump Johnson campaign and he kind of got shoved aside by the party. Ford, when he became president upon the resignation of Nixon, which was in 73. No, Ford could not have. He could have ran. Well, he did run in 76. But if he won in 76, he could not have ran in 80. That was the last time it happened. All right. Questions? Oh, actually, I had it. The reason why LBJ could, because there was 1 year, 59 days left of Kennedy's term, and Ford could not because... Oh, wait, no, Ford could have. Because there was 2 years, 137 days. Oh. Alrighty then. Never mind. My bad. Alright, questions on the 22nd Amendment and its impact on the V. POTUS.
And as we discussed,
under the 25th Amendment. The 25th Amendment not only clarifies, finally, that if the vice president becomes president, they are in fact president, not acting president. The 25th Amendment also deals with what happens if the president is incapacitated, which I talked about. But here's the interesting thing. Under the 25th Amendment, for the first time in U.S. history, Congress decided to deal with what happens if there is a V-POTUS vacancy. Under the 25th Amendment, if the V-POTUS dies or resigns or is removed, then the president has the power to nominate a vice president. But the nominee must pass both chambers of Congress by a majority vote. So, vacancy for the V-POTUS. POTUS dominates, but both chambers must approve the nomination by a majority. So it's not like a typical presidential appointee where only the Senate is involved. If it's the vice president, both chambers are involved. Now, FYI, that has happened twice. When Nixon's second vice presidential candidate, Spiro Agnew, resigned on October 10th, 1973, Nixon selected the House Minority Leader, Gerald Ford. Now, interestingly enough, Nixon was a Republican president, but do not forget, before Watergate, he was one of the most popular presidents in the 20th century. He won re-election for his second term by winning 49 of 50 states. The only state that didn't vote for Nixon was Massachusetts. Congress was had a majority of Democrats in both chambers. But Ford, because of his ability to work in a bipartisan manner, he was nominated as vice president in both chambers almost unanimously. Because back then, it was a different time than what it is today. Well, then Nixon resigned, and Ford becomes president. Well, Ford then had to nominate a vice president. And he selected four-time governor of New York, Nelson Rockefeller. So the mechanism for filling a vice presidential vacancy happened twice in a year. Yes?
Is Rockefeller Plaza named after him?
Yes. Imagine that. New York actually had a Republican governor that was popular. Go figure. Times were different back then. Times were different. Yes?
Is Rockefeller one of the six families that like owns everything in the world?
Yes, he's oh, yeah, of that family. Yeah, 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 yeah.
Is that when he became introduced in politics? Like, that's where he got his break?
No, there have been many Rockefellers that were involved in politics.
Oh, okay.
And business as well. Other questions? All right, well, this is probably the most although the whole presidential section was kind of technical, but make sure you understand the nuances for the test. Because watch what's going to happen. Ooh. I knew that was coming. No pictures, though, on this one. All right. We've done the first branch. So we've covered Article 1 of the Constitution. We've done the second branch. We've covered Article 2. Now we're going to do the final section for our next exam, and that is the judicial branch, which was created in Article 3. See, Zach, Roman, Allison made it in. No Elizabeth, no Nick. Ernest just came in, and Rich was here, but he went to the little boy's room. All right. We know what the framers' attitude on Congress was. We know what the framers' attitude on the executive branch was. What about the judiciary? Well, the framers, just like with the Congress and the presidency, they designed the federal judiciary based on their experiences. On one hand, they understood the need for strong administration of justice. The framers, most of them were lawyers, and they strongly believed that courts were necessary to protect the natural liberties of all U.S. citizens. So, they knew the courts had to be created. But, I don't know why two came up, but must be a screw up in my animation. But they also knew of the dangers of the courts. During the colonial period, most of the judges were appointed by governors. But most of the governors of the colonies were appointed by the crown. Ipso facto, most of the judges in the courts in the English colonies, therefore, sided with the crown if there was a dispute between the interests of the colonists and the government. But most of the judges were actually colonists themselves. And they received their pay from the colonial assemblies. So the judges essentially had to walk the fine line. If they don't do what the crown wants, they're going to get removed. They're going to lose their job. But if they don't do what the colonists like, they're not going to get paid. And as tensions, if you know American history, that appeared in the 1760s, in the 1770s, resulted in constant clashes, judges were often put in the middle. That's one of the reasons why they created what were called the Admiralty Courts. Most areas of contention dealt with the collection of duties and taxes. So an admiralty court was a special court that existed in all of the cities that had major ports. And the presiding judges were sent over from England. And in the admiralty courts, there were no juries. So they had what were called bench trials, where the judge was both the trier of fact and trier of the law. Interestingly, though, under the Articles of Confederation, there is no reference to a federal judiciary. The reason being is, if you recall, under the Articles of Confederation, the states were in power. And all of the states had court systems. Why did they want to give up authority to the federal government when they could control all legal matters within their borders? But as the 1780s played out, and the states began battling against one another over duties and tariffs and boundary disputes, many of the framers of the U.S. Constitution started realizing, you know something? We actually kind of do need a national court system to kind of keep the dispute between the states in check. But this was terrifying. And if you ever in your life have opportunity to read, you know, papers that came from the Federalists or papers that come from the Anti-Federalists, the idea of a federal judiciary was a constant theme, particularly in the Anti-Federalist papers. And their concerns were valid. What happens if the federal courts start interfering in state law, in state matters? What happens if the federal courts try striking down state laws? And then what about accountability? How can the states check and balance federal courts? Who are they going to answer to? Are they going to answer to the president? Are they going to answer to Congress? Are they going to answer to the state legislatures? So, there was a lot of fear. There was a lot of apprehension in the idea of creating these federal courts. And again, pay attention to the news. There are constant stories of individual federal judges sticking their noses into business. And that creates conflict. Well, after working all summer on Article 1 in particular, and then hammering out Article 2, as time was winding down, when it got to the idea of the federal judiciary, the delegates in attendance essentially made a huge compromise. They recognized the need for a federal judiciary, so they created Article 3. They also recognized the need to have a top court. So Article 3 creates the Supreme Court of the United States. Article 3 also creates the jurisdiction of that court. And it limited it down to two areas. And we'll talk about the areas of jurisdiction. But there are only two areas of the U.S. Supreme Court, types of cases they can hear. But that's it. All of the rest of the makeup of the federal judiciary was to be left to Congress, including the number of justices on the Supreme Court. But how are you going to keep the justices on the Supreme Court out of politics? Well, Article 3 has them nominated by the president, but confirmed with the advice and consent of the Senate. So the president wants to put somebody in there, but it's the Senate's job to vet. How are they going to have judicial independence? To adhere to the law first and foremost. Well, once they're there, they have life tenure, commonly referred to as good behavior tenure. They can stay there so long as they have a heartbeat. But checks and balances. What happens if you have a justice that goes off the rails and goes completely rogue? Well, the justices on the Supreme Court are subject to the impeachment process. Same as the president, same as any member of the cabinet. And as I said, there was one Supreme Court justice that was actually impeached. This was supposed to be the compromise. So, if you do have a federal court that goes rogue, Congress has the ability to eliminate the court. If the federal courts become intrusive, the Congress has a right to change the jurisdiction. So essentially, this was the balance between the people who were terrified and the people who recognized there was a legitimate need. And like everything that's involved in the Constitution, that's one of the things that makes it great. And that's one of the reasons why you never, ever want to support anybody who says we need to make a new Constitution. Because in this modern era, there will be no compromise. It will be purely partisan. And they'll never be able to do it again. All right, questions? All right. What can the federal courts do? Well, here's redundancy. I already said Article 3, Section 1 creates only the SCOTUS. But it does state that the SCOTUS, by the way, Supreme Court of the United States, just like POTUS v. POTUS, it does state that the SCOTUS is the highest court in the land. So what does this mean? Very simple. If the Supreme Court makes a determination, it essentially is national law. That applies to everybody within the borders and the territories of these United States of America. The rest, that's determined by Congress. All right, what subject matter are the federal courts entrusted to? Well, this can be found in Article 3, Section 2, Clause 1. The first types of cases that the federal courts are supposed to deal with are referred to as cases involving federal questions. What do you think a federal question is?
Something like either opposing or supporting like federal law.
Yeah. Anything, if Congress makes a law and there's a situation that arises under it, you go to federal court. You don't go to a state court. What's another area of a federal question? Impeachment does not go to the courts whatsoever. No. What about the Constitution of the United States itself? If you claim that your constitutional rights are being violated, if it's a matter that's in the federal Constitution, you go to federal courts. The other area, treaties. If the United States government makes a treaty with another nation and there's some type of dispute under the treaty, it goes to the federal courts. Think of Hunter v. Martin's laissez, that case we talked about, where Virginia took all of the private land of the British noble and basically sold it all out. And the guy came back and sued. The only reason why it got up to the Supreme Court was because under the treaty, the United States promised that all of the British subjects would get compensation if the states took any land. So that would be a federal question. You know what also is a federal question? Any dispute between states. And yes, there are very frequently disputes between states that are filed. Now, interestingly enough, they have their trial before the Supreme Court. So most recently, there was a case, this went up a few years ago. It was between Georgia and Tennessee, and it was over water. Tennessee, with the TVA and their dam systems generating hydroelectric energy, they were not allowing the waters to flow downstream. And what's south of Tennessee but Georgia? So as a result, Georgia, this was, actually it might have been longer than I'm thinking. I think Obama was president. Essentially, the south was having a really bad drought, and Tennessee was not letting the water flow because they needed to have electricity for their residents. Georgia actually took Tennessee,
to court suing, saying Tennessee needed to open up the water more, and the Supreme Court ended up siding with Tennessee, not Georgia. But luckily, then it started raining, and then it went away. A hand went up.
What are those like disputes like the setup of like the court look like if it's like two states?
It's just like a trial. So the nine justices sit on their platform, and you have two tables. You have the plaintiff and you have the defendant.
Yeah.
So whatever state is bringing the suit, they act as the plaintiff. In the state that's being sued, they act as the defendant.
Is it
and
like,
typically they have the attorney generals go down.
Okay, all right.
Other questions? All right, federal question. U.S. law, U.S. Constitution, U.S. treaties, disputes between the states. The other type of case is known as cases arising from diversity of citizenship. Any guess what this means?
Seems kind of straightforward.
Does it? Take a swing at it.
So your multicultural ethnicities and the area that you're in, your economy, diversity of citizenship, so everybody who's a citizen in that area is of different race or different descent, and they clash in ideas of it?
Nope. Everyone always says that. I've only had one student in the 30 years I've been teaching get it right.
Damn. All right, I got to try now.
Huh?
Immigration status?
How so?
I mean, dealing with issues of illegal immigration.
Nope.
Hang on.
Not even close.
Okay.
Do different states have different, like, requirements, but for lack of a better term, for you to be a legal citizen?
Yeah, isn't there like a test?
So like, Massachusetts has...
You're the second person to get it right. Who originally determined, most people say what you say or what you say, who originally determined citizenship? It was the states controlled citizens. There was no such thing as United States citizenship until passage of the 14th Amendment. Originally, if you wanted to come across the pond and enter the United States, every single state set up laws setting basic requirements for you to be allowed off the boat. And if you did not meet those qualifications, you got back on the boat, and the ship captain had to pay to bring you back, because you would not be allowed in.
So what's the whole diversity of citizenship?
If you are a citizen, although today we would refer to it as a resident of Massachusetts, and you were suing a resident of Rhode Island,
okay,
you could file your suit in federal court. Why? Well, very simple. If you are a resident of Massachusetts and you sue someone from Rhode Island in Massachusetts, it's very likely that your jury would be biased to you because you are a fellow resident. Remember, it's a jury of your peers. Or if you would have brought suit in Rhode Island against a Rhode Islander, you could have the jury be biased against you. Because diversity suits are civil claims. They're not criminal. Anything dealing with money. So, when the framers put this in, they figured the federal courts would be neutral arbiters of justice. Now, by the way, under the First Judiciary Act, there was a federal court in every single one of the states. So, if you were a citizen of Massachusetts and you got in a fender bender, your car was totaled, and your spouse died, you could actually go to Boston and file a claim in that federal court. Because what is the jurisdiction of the federal courts?
National law.
The United States. Now here's the thing, if you were to go into Massachusetts court and file that claim, the Massachusetts court has no jurisdiction over residents or citizens of Rhode Island. So they could subpoena, but it's a civil claim. There's nothing Massachusetts can do to force the person to show up. But if you go to federal court, they can send U.S. Marshals, and they can go get you and bring you to court. Questions? So don't think, I actually had a student back when I used to teach at Nichols. He thought his landlord was a douchebag. I think he was from Colorado, and he's like, yeah, I haven't paid him all semester long, and I'm graduating, and I'm going home, and I'm not going to pay him. And I'm like, he's going to get you. And he's like, what do you mean? I'm like, well, that's a civil claim. He can either file in federal court, or he can file it in Massachusetts court, get a default judgment because you don't show up, and then he can use the federal court system to file it in Colorado. They will catch you. It'll take time, but you'll get a big bill. So don't think you can avoid the long arm of the law. And again, this was the desire, because there were many disputes that were going on between residents of the states. Yes?
When you said that each state originally had its own federal court.
There would be a court that would be opened up, in all of the states.
Was it essentially like a Supreme Court for each state?
No. It was just a trial court. So if there was a federal question or a diversity suit, that's where you would go and file your claim. Okay. Good question. Other questions? All right. Anything else? That's a state court matter. So if there's an issue of state law, if there's an issue of death, so you got to probate a will, if there's a situation of a contract dispute, all of that are state court or state questions. Questions? And speaking of the First Judiciary Act, there we go. Wait, where am I going? Oh. What about the Supreme Court? Okay, I see what I did. So this is the jurisdiction of the federal courts. This is the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court. There are two areas. Actually, I'll put them both up there. I'll talk about them both back to back. In Article 3, the Supreme Court, the top court in the land, Constitution says there's only two ways to get all the way up. The first is original jurisdiction. Original jurisdiction. This is the state versus the state battle that falls under original jurisdiction. Because original jurisdiction involves any case which the United States is party to. So if you're going to sue the federal government, you're going to have your case trial in the Supreme Court. Or if it's a state versus a state dispute, you're going to go in there. Or it's a suit involving any U.S. official. So if you're going to try suing the president, you're going to go to the Supreme Court. If the president is the president.
And you're suing him in the capacity being president, not personal.
Original jurisdiction also involves any disputes with Indian tribes and foreign nations. Questions? Question? Didn't you just want to go and pat the dog? I did too, all soft and fluffy.
All right, what about appellate jurisdiction? Well, appellate means appeal.
So, if you have your trial, either a diversity suit or a federal question, in a federal district court, and you file an appeal, it potentially could be appealed and get all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. Which, coincidentally, that's how most of the cases that are heard by the Supreme Court get to the Supreme Court, through the appellate jurisdiction.
And we'll talk more about the particulars of that next class.
Questions?
So original jurisdiction, states, U.S., ambassadors, ministers of the United States, and if the foreign country. It's going to be before the Supreme Court. Appellate jurisdiction, if you are going to appeal from a trial court, you could potentially get all the way up there. Oh,
the difference? Original jurisdiction will be a trial. Appellate jurisdiction, it will be an appeal hearing. And again, I'll talk about the differences when we later.
Just trying to finish up the Constitution stuff. All right, any questions on anything on this page? Because I think it's going to go to the next. Yes?
What's the difference between a judge and a justice?
Title. A justice usually implies a superior position.
Okay.
A judge typically hears the trials. A justice typically hears the appeals.
Okay.
That's a good question. I don't think I've ever been asked that. Other questions? You're just like crushing it today, dude.
Oh.
If I gave out little gold stars, I'd put one on your forehead.
Thanks.
Anyone else? All right.
So how does our structure of our federal courts? Well, it goes all the way back to one of the first laws that was passed by the first Congress. Back in 1789, in a law called the Federal Judiciary Act. This was one of the longest laws, in terms of most sections and clauses and articles, that were passed by the first Congress. Because this essentially would be the blueprint for our federal court system. And rather than worrying about all of the different subject areas and all of the nuances, we're going to focus on three basic areas. The most important thing that this law did was it set the hierarchy of our court system. And it's like a pyramid in terms of the number of filings. At the lowest level, there are what are known as district courts. The district courts are the bottom rung of the pyramid, and it's in the district courts where the trials take place. A trial, like you've seen on TV. So there's a judge, there's a jury, there's presentation of evidence, there's presentation of witnesses. The jury then deliberates. If it's a criminal trial, and someone is being accused of committing a crime, the jury must rule unanimously beyond a reasonable doubt. All that stuff, what you know of trials, that takes place down in the district court level. Now, not trying to make it complicated, but in the years since, they've also created subject matter specific courts. So, for instance, there is the Military Court of Justice. You know, there are the Admiralty Courts that deal with maritime matters. There are the bankruptcy courts. Those have all been added since, but regardless of the subject matter, it's still the same. You go in and you have your trial. Now, what happens if something
goes wrong? Well, the founding fathers realized that nobody is perfect and everybody makes mistakes. So, following the English system, they said, well, if there's a mistake, you should have a right to get an appeal. So above, the trial courts are what are commonly referred to as the circuit courts, or sometimes the circuit courts of appeal. These are the trial courts. Now, why are they called the circuit courts? Well, originally, justices of the Supreme Court would ride around the different circuits, the districts, because the districts were made up of multiple states. But in today's era, the United States is divided into 13 different circuits. There's 12 that are in the different states, and there's one that's down in D.C. And they are special justices that sit on those courts. No longer are the Supreme Court justices. Do they preside over them? Little spoiler. You don't get an appeal because you lost. You only get an appeal if something went wrong. And we'll get specific next class. Yes?
Is it up to you to determine that?
Or? No. Okay. You know who determines it? The justices on the appeals court.
Is that just for criminal?
Or civil as well.
Civil as well?
But the only way you can get an appeal is not a new trial. An appeal is a hearing to determine if what you claim went wrong is the truth.
So, this is kind of like a personal story, but I'm wondering how it like correlates with this. So I got a speeding ticket, and like I was in the wrong, like from a legal standpoint, right? But so I was able to appeal it, even though...
That's... kind of. By appealing, you are going to go before a judge or a clerk magistrate. You're not going to go before a judge. Oh, okay. You're not going to have a trial.
So that's okay.
Right. And what you're doing is you're claiming that the cop was wrong.
Okay.
That's what you're doing. You're appealing getting the ticket. That's not the same as an appeal hearing.
Okay.
Appealing a decision that was made by a trial court. Same word, though. Other questions? All right, well, at the top of the mountain is the SCOTUS. And we know the SCOTUS is either accessible directly through original jurisdiction, or it's accessed through the appellate process. So if you have a trial and you think there was a mistake, you go before appeals court, and if the appeals court wants to hear your appeal, they review it. They may decide that you were right, that there was a mistake. They may decide there was no mistake. Well, both parties then have the ability to appeal that decision, and if the Supreme Court wants to hear it, then you'll go before the highest court in the land. FYI, there are typically hundreds of thousands of cases that are filed in the trial courts. Maybe any given year, maybe 10,000 appeal hearings. You know how many cases the Supreme Court typically hears in a year?
Minimum.
10.
A little more than 10. Usually about somewhere between 50 and 70. So what I'm saying is most cases get dealt with here. Very few proportionally get an appeal, and even fewer get all the way up to the Supreme Court.
I have a quick question.
Sure.
So I hear of cases sometimes taking a really long time to get up to the Supreme Court.
Yep.
And then I hear of other cases that get up to the Supreme Court very quickly.
Yep.
So what does that process look like, and why is it different for different matters?
Because the appeals justices have discretion. So you can file a request to get what's known as a certiorari petition. That's an appeal for a higher court to take up your claim. If
It's a matter that occurs during a trial. Typically, those are quick because it's not based on the outcome. It's based on maybe the judge allowed, for example, hearsay, witness testimony, which is something that's not admissible under both the federal and state rules of court procedure.
Right.
So in that instance, the appeals court would review the presentation of the evidence and they'd make a quick determination. If it's something dealing with the outcome, prejudice by the jury, that's more complicated. Typically, the appeals court will wait until all of the mechanisms at the trial court will take place. Then, when everything has been exercised, then the appeals court will take it. But the appeals court basically has the power to send it back down for a new trial.
Yeah.
So sometimes you see a lot of bouncing between the two before it gets up.
It's like that El Salvador judge thing, that was like that. Like, I mean, that went up to the Supreme Court immediately.
Well, that would be a significant constitutional crisis.
Yeah.
So the Supreme Court, who has discretion, felt it was necessary to basically set the trial courts back into proper alignment. Because they didn't want all of the hundreds of federal judges basically going rogue.
Yeah.
Because that would result in significant constitutional violations.
You know how the Menendez brothers are getting a resentencing?
That is a state court decision, but yes, I know about it.
So it doesn't go through that?
That will go through that in the state court system. Okay. Won't go into the federal courts. Because murder is a common law crime, and that's a state question.
Okay.
Other questions? All right. Two quick nerdy things. Hopefully I can get through them both, and then we'll call it a class. Oh, sorry. That would be the third thing. So the Judiciary Act. It created the trial courts, created the circuit courts, and it set the number of justices. Originally, there were six. There were five associate justices and one chief justice. Does anyone know who the first Chief Justice of these United States was?
John.
No. John, though, but not Marshall. Wrong John. Not Adams. He was Vice President. John Jay. John Jay was the first Chief Justice. All right. Not that you need to know that. By the way, how many justices we have today? Nine. We've had nine justices of the Supreme Court since 1866 or 7 or 8. It was post-Civil War. Because it was nine before, and then during the 1850s they dropped it down to 8, and then they put it back up to 9. All right. Quick matter. During the first two decades of the... Actually, no. We'll say... the Washington years and the Adam years. So we'll say the first 12 years. There really was not much going on, and hardly any cases actually got all the way up to the Supreme Court. Ironically, we actually had a justice on the Supreme Court, John Rutledge, who was a Supreme Court justice for an entire year, and he never actually sat and help preside over a case. Because the very first case to get before the Supreme Court didn't happen until 2 years after the Supreme Court technically was created. And by the way, when the first session of the U.S. Supreme Court took place, they didn't even have their own building. They met in the basement in where the federal government was operating in New York City. The very first case heard by the Supreme Court was Barnes v. West. Very exciting story. West was a Revolutionary War general and an anti-federalist. And he owned a mortgage on a very large farm that was down in Scituate, Rhode Island. Well, he received permission from Rhode Island to run a lottery to raise money
to pay his debts because he was a general. So they allowed him special privileges. The problem was, is most of the money was continental currency, continental dollars. Well, in 1785, Rhode Island recognized the validity of paper money. So West is allowed to run this. Rhode Island says paper money is good. So West raises this money and he tries paying his mortgage to Barnes. But Barnes refuses to take a big basket of continental dollars. The reason being, continental dollars were worth nothing by 1786. So Barnes wanted specie, gold and silver coins. Well, Barnes filed a claim in the federal court under diversity of citizenship. Why? Barnes lived in Massachusetts. But the property was in Rhode Island. So long story short, it gets heard by the circuit court, and then the court rejected it, basically saying that West's argument was not valid because Rhode Island allows this. So the other party filed a claim, gets up to the Supreme Court. And in an action-packed decision, Barnes was told by the Supreme Court, you have to accept paper money because the law of the state in which the property was in allows for paper money. So the fact that the paper money is worth nothing doesn't matter. Take it and be happy with it. Action-packed decision, wasn't it? Yes.
So there was still...
I'm not done yet. Just give me one. I know I'm running late.
There was still independent state currency.
Yes, there was still state currency going around. There was the continental dollars. There were still British gold coins and silver coins. It was a mess. And that's one of the reasons why under the U.S. Constitution they created a national currency. All right, we're going to come back. We've got a couple of more significant cases that we've got to review. And then we're going to see and understand how the court system goes. So I will see you all on Wednesday. And sorry for keeping you late.